Welcome back to Cartels, Conspiracies, and Camarena. I'm Jack Llewellyn. Last week, I talked about one of the questions I get asked a lot when people have listened to the podcast or read my book. And that was, you know, is there any path forward? How are the cartels ever going to be really combated or taken down? We went through that last week. One of the other questions that I get very often is the topic for today. And that essentially is the question of, is Mexico safe or should I go to Mexico? And I think the fact that so many people ask that question is a real tragedy when you think about it. And I want to explore that. So one of the first things I tell people, and when we're thinking through this, you know, Mexico is a very large country with a very diverse population. Mexico is the 13th largest country in terms of area, and it's the 10th most populous nation on the planet. It's only about a fifth of the size of the United States, but if you put Mexico in, say you put centered it over Denver or so, you would have parts of Mexico that would stretch to Seattle, into Texas, and then as far east as Kentucky and Tennessee. So it's a big area, and it has an incredibly diverse geography and ecology. And it's, you know, from a number of perspectives, it's a fascinating country. You have deserts, you have mountains, you have unbelievable history. You have the beaches and the shores and the ocean. I mean, it's an amazing country with a lot of historical and cultural significance, right? I love everything about Teotihuacan and the Aztec Empire. Those are different, but separate ideas, but I'm fascinated by them. There's just so much in Mexico. And what this cartel situation, you know, the drug trafficking, the violence, everything that goes together with the cartels and the wars amongst the cartels is resulting in a loss of culture and heritage, not just in Mexico, but with foreign travelers as well. And I want to go through and talk about that a little bit. This idea also came from someone who sent me an email. This was a few weeks ago, and said that they had basically binged listened to the podcast while they were driving from Ciudad Juarez to Denver. And they suggested that I do a podcast episode on kind of how the situation in Juarez got so bad. So what I want to do today is talk about Ciudad Juarez, or just Juarez, and I want to do it in a couple of ways. So first, I want to just give you an idea of the really deep history of this city and the area. Then we're going to talk about the influence of the cartels, particularly the Juarez cartel, and how that cartel's establishment, its rise into power, and then its virtual fall has precipitated a lot of the violence being seen today. We'll also talk a little bit more about where Juarez is today as far as the current situation. And then at the end, I'm going to quote from an article that I read that puts a human face on some of the issues facing Ciudad Juarez, and you can substitute numerous other cities in Mexico for Juarez. But we're going to look at that human side of it to conclude. So let's talk about the history of Juarez, and both with respect to the history of Juarez and the history of the Juarez cartel. We're going to, you know, this is an overview, right? We could spend hours several episodes, many days, talking about each of these in depth. For all practical purposes, the city of Juarez was founded in about 1659. It was founded as a result of Spanish explorers in the 1600s looking for a route through the southern Rocky Mountains. And the Franciscan friar Garcia de San Francisco founded the city in 1959 as El Paso del Norte, the North Pass. Franciscan friars, very important in the growth of the community, and they established a community that became more and more important as there was commerce between Santa Fe and Chihuahua, and that route of commerce passed right through what we now call Juarez. In 1680, during the Pueblo Revolt, some of the indigenous people became refugees. As a result, a mission was established in about 1683, and it is the Presidio de Nuestra Señora del Pilar del Paso del Rio Norte. The longest name for a mission I've ever seen. The city was also very important during the Mexican-American War. A notable battle, the Battle of El Bracito, took place near Juarez on Christmas Day in 1846. The Mexican-American War is also notable in that the 1848 Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo established the Rio Grande River as the border between the United States and Mexico. A border adjustment occurred in 1853 when a territory or piece of land known as La Mesilla was sold to the United States. So that created a new border line whereby the Rio Grande began precisely, or the border line began precisely in Paso del Norte. And that, again, really established it as a border town and an important border town. There was a French intervention in Mexico during the period from 1862 to 1867. And a commander by the name of Benito Juarez, his forces stopped temporarily in El Paso del Norte. And then he established a government in exile in Chihuahua. In 1882, the city grew because of the arrival of the Mexican Central Railway. This allowed the city to grow again. You had banks, you had telegraph, telephone services, then and even trams appeared. In 1888, El Paso del Norte was renamed in honor of Benito Juarez. By 1910, the city had become Mexico's largest border town. In May of 1911, during the Mexican Revolution, about 3,000 revolutionary fighters under the leadership of Francisco Madero laid siege to Ciudad Juarez, which was garrisoned by 500 regular federal troops under the command of General Juan José Navarro. Navarro's force was supported by 300 civilian auxiliaries and local police. After 2 days of heavy fighting, most of the city had fallen to the insurrectionists, and the surviving federal soldiers had withdrawn to their barracks. General Navarro, then formally surrendered to Madero. The capture of this key border town early in the revolutionary stages enabled the revolutionary forces to get new weapons and supplies, bring them in from El Paso, and it really marked the beginning of the end for the established regime. Once, obviously it took time, But the loss of Juarez really was a harbinger of things to come, and it demoralized the national troops. During subsequent years of the conflict, Pancho Villa and others struggled for control of the town. There were battles in 1911 and 1913 that destroyed a lot of the town. In fact, so much so that between the years of, say, 1914 to 1917, much of the population actually abandoned the city. Starting in about the 1920s until the 40s or so, the city really recovered based on tourism, gambling, light manufacturing. NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, went into effect on January 1, 1994, and that also spurred additional growth in the city. Indulge me for a moment, please. I want to talk about one thing that I found really interesting, and it's something that I had known about for, well, since I was an undergrad student, and I'll explain that in just a second. There was a strip of land called El Chamizal, and El Chamizal, about 600 acres, so not an insignificant strip, but it was on the border between El Paso and Ciudad Juarez. The problem was, depending on how the Rio Grande was running, the El Chamizal strip was sometimes in Mexico and sometimes in the United States. And there was a survey in about 1852, which created all kinds of tensions, right, between the governments of the two states. President Taft and President Diaz had a summit in October of 1909 where this issue came up, and the tensions around this were so high that allegedly there was one or more assassination attempts or efforts or plans that were thwarted in the process. So in, let's see, in 1964, Presidents Adolfo Lopez Mateos and Lyndon Johnson met at the border to discuss the dispute. Previously, the U.S. Congress had introduced something called the American-Mexican Chamizal Convention Act of 1964, which was designed to settle the matter. In October 1967, President Johnson met with President Gustavo Diaz Ordaz at the border and formally proclaimed the settlement. The Chamizal Convention also resulted in the construction of a man-made channel that was constructed of concrete, about 167 feet in width, 15 feet deep. The two countries shared the cost of the channel and a couple of new bridges, but the idea was that this channel would prevent the Rio Grande from blurring the international boundary in the future. In El Paso, there's the Chamizal National Memorial that was established in the 1970s, and there's a park and things now. One of the things that's fascinating about this Chamizal dispute, or at least fascinating to me, and I know this is a little bit astray, but I was a political science undergrad, and my professor, Alan Lamborn, who had as much influence over me and my education and my legal career as any educator or almost anybody else in my life. Anyways, he wrote a book when I was in an undergrad and taking most of his classes that talked about these efforts to, you know, to decide where the Chamizal Strip should go. And most particularly, presidents and even congressional leaders kind of proclaiming, all right, just give it to Mexico, just work it out. And what was interesting is there was a little fiefdom, a bureaucratic fiefdom that had been built up over the management and oversight of this little strip of land. And so even after these events in the 70s and things that I talked about, you know, starting with Johnson in 63 and 67, and then some subsequent events, it took many more years before the government bureaucrats that were in charge of El Chamizal to actually relinquish control. It's a fascinating exploration into how bureaucratic agencies can manipulate things in a way to kind of maintain their position, notwithstanding some political changes or some political direction. All right. So when did Ciudad Juarez kind of fall prey to cartel influences? You can say that you can trace this back to the 20s and 30s when heroin from the poppy fields in the southern part of Chihuahua were shipped through Juarez to go into the United States. But for all practical purposes, the real rise of cartels and a cartel-like influence occurred in the 1970s. And what had happened was Juarez at that point was starting to become a manufacturing center. And so there were a large group, a large wave of newcomers moving from other places in Mexico to Juarez, where there was jobs and opportunity and economic vitality. That, in a lot of ways, precipitated some of the cartel activities. We've had a couple of different episodes where we've talked about the Juarez cartel, and we've talked about the cartel itself. We've talked about some of the leaders. And so I don't want to kind of belabor things that we've already talked about, but I do want to walk through kind of the history of the Juarez cartel and other cartels in Ciudad Juarez to give you an idea of how things have changed. Most people say the cartel was founded in the 1970s somewhere, right? Not necessarily a specific date. And for most of its early years, it was run by Pablo Acosta Villarreal. As you'll remember, Villarreal was killed in April 1987 in a raid by MFJP, or Mexican Federal Police, sorry, helicopters in a village known as Santa Elena in Chihuahua. So after Acosta is killed, the cartel is run by two people. And a lot of discussion about how they work together and things, but two people were basically in charge: Rafael Aguilar Guajardo and then Amado Carrillo Fuentes. Carrillo Fuentes, notably, is the nephew of Ernesto Fonseca Carrillo, who we all know. Guajardo was killed in 1993, and most people believe that he was killed by or at the direction of or on orders from Amado Carrillo. Upon Guajardo's death, Amado seizes control, becomes the absolute leader of the cartel. He also brought his brothers into the business. As I said, we've talked a lot about Amado Carrillo before. El Señor de los Cielos, Lord of the Skies. Things run reasonably well for a few years. And Amato becomes one, if not the biggest narcotics trafficker in Mexico, and rivaled, frankly, any cartel or any trafficker in the Western Hemisphere at that time. He dies on or about July 4th, 1997. And at the time of his death, it's estimated that he was worth $25 billion. That's billion with a B. 1997 money, $25 billion, estimated to be closer to $40 to $45 billion in today's dollars. There was, of course, and continues to be, some controversy over his death. And controversy might be too strong of a word. There are conspiracy theorists who would love to believe that Amato is still alive. He faked his death and he's on a desert island someplace with Elvis and Tupac. What actually happened is he went in for plastic surgery to change his look. And he died during surgery. We know that the surgeons who performed the surgery ended up dying in a cement casket a short time later. I think that's highly, highly, highly likely that Amato did in fact die in 1997. His death changes everything for Ciudad Juarez. And it doesn't take long for that to become apparent. August 3, 1997, about 9:30 p.m., four drug traffickers walked into a restaurant in Ciudad Juarez, opened fire on five diners, killed them instantly. Police said that there were more than 100 bullet casings. An LA Times report said that the men were carrying at least two AK-47s while there were others at the doorstep. In addition to the diners who were killed, an off-duty police officer ran to the scene. He also was killed. It ended up being found out after his death that he was involved with the Juarez cartel. Now, why does that incident say anything important about the changes coming in the Juarez cartel? If you read contemporaneous reports, there is a great deal of anecdotal evidence that while there were skirmishes internally within the Juarez cartel and occasional incursions by other traffickers and things, the violence was kept out of the public view. And so for something like this to happen in Ciudad Juarez at a restaurant and very public, that was a very distinct change. The other thing, and we talked about this when we talked about Amado Carrillo, the other thing that happened is Carrillo was able to become as successful and as prolific as he was because he had direct ties to Mexico's top-ranking drug interdiction officer. That was Division General Jesus Gutierrez Rebollo. And if you remember, shortly after Amado's death, Gutierrez Rebollo was arrested himself. And so all of a sudden, that air of invincibility and the protection surrounding the Juarez cartel was gone. And there's another point I want to make, but we'll do that in just a second. So after Amado dies in 97, there becomes a turf war for control of the cartel. How many times have we seen this? Succession becomes difficult. So Amato's brother ends up kind of prevailing in this battle. So the brother, Vincent Carrillo Fuentes, takes over. Importantly, Vincent Carrillo Fuentes forms a partnership with Juan José Espinoza Moreno, El Azul, his brother Rodolfo Carrillo Fuentes, his nephew Vicente Carrillo Leyva, Ricardo García Urquiza, and they formed an alliance with the Sinaloa cartel, both with El Mayo and with El Chapo. And remember, this time period where the Sinaloa cartel kind of had, you know, peace treaties, if you will, with lots of different players, was an interesting time, and there were lots of repercussions when they went away. Remember, we talked about the impact that had on the BLO, and there were other organizations as well. So when Carrillo Fuentes or Vicente takes over, there still is that power vacuum, where the relationship and the strength of the cartels had changed. When Amato was in charge, the Juarez cartel had a certain prestige and a certain power. He demanded a certain level of respect. That changed with his death. And so what comes to happen in the 90s and going into the 2000s is there are alliances that change things. And one of the things that happens is in 2001, El Chapo escapes from prison. And at that point, a lot of members of the Juarez cartel defected to the Sinaloa cartel, and particularly to El Chapo's kind of portion of it. In 2004, Vicente's brother was killed, allegedly by order of El Chapo. Vicente then retaliated by assassinating El Chapo's brother in prison. This ignited a turf war between the two cartels. And during this period, there also was the Sinaloa cartel's war against the Gulf cartel. And then, remember, a little while later, you end up with the situation where BLO, Beltran Leyva organization, is fighting with El Chapo. All of their goodwill had gone away because they blamed El Chapo for Alfredo's imprisonment or arrest. So then you get to a situation where by about 2007, Juarez is, the city of Juarez, is subject to a battle. A battle between the Juarez cartel and the Sinaloa cartel for control. Go back to when Amato was in charge. And I think you can extrapolate this or think about this in terms of current day structure as well with the Sinaloa cartel and with CJNG. Were there incidents between cartels, between drug traffickers during Amato's control of the cartel? Of course there were. But there wasn't an all-out war or battle for territory and for the city that you saw starting in 2007, more or less, between the Juarez cartel and CDS. That influence, the two that are openly battling with each other, is what precipitates and what leads to increased violence that no longer is hidden beneath the shadows, but is out front and open and everybody can see it. And that has very, you know, significant effects. Also, keep in mind that in 2006, Felipe Calderon starts the war on drugs. And we can talk forever, probably, but we could talk about what the reasons are. But it's undisputed that between about 2008 and 2012, there was a particularly violent era in Juarez. Query, the degree to which the war on drugs actually caused that violence. Right? Because now you've got military and police trying to come into the area. You have two cartels fighting for control. The stability that had existed under Amado, that had then decreased with the influx of the CDS, is now decreased even more because of the role of the government. Excuse me. In 2013, Mexican forces arrested an Alberto Carrillo Fuentes, who went by the alias Betty LaFay, Ugly Betty. Don't ask me why. He was arrested in Nayarit. It is said that he had taken the leadership of the organization in 2013 after Vicente Carrillo Fuentes kind of retired because of an illness. In any event, Vicente was captured in October of 2014. By 2018 or so, the decline in the Juarez cartel's power decreased even more. And it turns out that by at least 2020, if not earlier, La Línea, which was kind of its armed wing, mostly made up of former Chihuahua State Police officers, was not only the Juarez cartel's most powerful faction in Ciudad Juarez, but maybe its only real remnant. So now what do you have? You have Ciudad Juarez, you have La Línea, but you also have Los Salazar, which was the powerful cell of the Sinaloa cartel, which now had a significant presence in Ciudad Juarez. And then add to that, in recent years, you've had the CJNG with an outfit or a group called New Juarez Cartel, trying to establish some inroads in Ciudad Juarez. For the most part, it is believed that CJNG's influence in Ciudad Juarez is sporadic and limited, and that La Línea and Los Salazar are the main players in Ciudad Juarez. But again, go back to where we're talking about the government influence. If you have one player, the stability, and stability doesn't always mean good, but the stability is maximized. If you have two players of equal strength, the stability may be less than if you had one. If you have three players, that is inherently even more unstable. You can think of it in terms of United States, Russia, and China. You know, things are great when the United States was the only power. Then you've got Russia, then you've got the Cold War, but they have something called mutual assured destruction, so they can balance each other to some extent. You add China to the mix, and all of a sudden, things are unbalanced. You know, if two are allied on something, then one is left out. In that situation, three actors is less stable than two actors, which is less stable than one actor. So today, the Juarez cartel, such as it exists, is really defined by La Linea. There also is a group, Barrio Azteca, which is a gang that is prominent in border areas, El Paso and other areas, and historically had worked with the Juarez cartel. It's also said that some of the Los Zeta remnants are also allies of, again, the Juarez cartel, as much as you want to make of it. Its rivals are a lot. You have the Sinaloa cartel. You have CJNG. You have MS-13. You have the Knights Templar cartel, to the extent they still exist at all. The Gulf cartel. La Familia Michoacana. And we'll just use that as an overarching term for the new familia and the old one. And then the Tijuana cartel. Where does El Paso sit today? Ciudad Juarez. Ciudad Juarez economically is vibrant. The El Paso Regional Economic Development Corporation recently said that Ciudad Juarez is the metropolis absorbing more new industrial real estate space than any other North American city. It's a major manufacturing city. Companies such as Electrolux, Bosch, Foxconn, Flextronics, Lexmark, Delphi, Johnson Controls, Toro, Lear, Boeing, Cardinal Health, Siemens, Sumitomo, and others have major operations in Ciudad Juarez. Chihuahua itself is among the top five states in Mexico with the most foreign investment. So you have retail, banking, fast food, other things, service industry, businesses in Ciudad Juarez, in addition to the manufacturing. Juarez also has, you know, rich history and culture. We won't go into it too much. Some good examples of famous people from Juarez: Juan Acevedo, a baseball player; Johnny J, who's a rapper and the primary producer for Tupac; the singer Juan Gabriel; the wrestler Eddie Guerrero, and lots of others. I want to put a real face on this. You know, what's happening now because of the war on drugs, because of the cartels, because of the cartel wars, is really a tragedy. But sometimes I think we can look at it in this grand scale and not understand how it affects, you know, the people living there. And there was an article in Insight Crime a few weeks ago that I thought did a really good job with this, and I encourage you to read it. And Insight Crime, by the way, is great. I think they are really good. What this article does is it uses as a point of reference a primary school teacher named Lourdes, an alias name, and looks at the effect that the violence has had on her students and her life. And it says, "But starting in 2008, at the base of these mountains near the U.S.-Mexico border, a primary school teacher named Lourdes started to see young people killing each other daily without caring about religion, love for their neighbor, or the presence of the students attending school nearby. 15 years later, while the total number of killings has decreased, Juarez remains one of the most homicidal cities in Mexico. Today, young people are still murdering each other at an alarming rate. Just prior to the end of 2023, the city accounted for more than half of the homicides recorded in the state of Chihuahua. Goes on. Routine violence is occasionally punctuated by particularly gruesome incidents. In May, a drug rehabilitation center operating near Lourdes' school became the scene of a shocking episode in which two staff members beat a patient and suffocated her to death. They dissected the body to remove the skin and muscles until the bones were free, then removed the intestines, placed them in buckets with acids, and proceeded to grind everything in a blender. She says, "We just try to give them some hope. The authorities don't realize that these children need a lot of support. So that's what we try to do with what little we have." This was terrible. Lourdes remembered one particularly difficult day in May when about 20 students closely followed instructions given by their dance teacher as they prepared for a performance for Mother's Day. However, more than half of the girls and boys eventually decided not to take part, some because their mothers had been killed, others because they knew their mothers would not come due to being jailed or addicted to drugs. Some children did not make it to school at all. Between 2010 and 2020, the population of Juarez grew from about 1.3 million to 1.5 million. And listen to this. But the number of students who finished primary school during that time dropped more than 50%. Let me repeat that. But the number of students who finished primary school during that time period dropped more than 50%, from 174,366 in 2010 to just 77,832 in 2020. The article then says, due to lack of institutional support, there were and still are primarily two paths for the young people Lourdes teaches. Join the ranks of warring criminal groups, fall into alcohol and drug addiction, or both. Across Mexico, Juarez has one of the highest rates of drug addiction. This is due in part to the city's geographic proximity to the United States, the primary destination for drugs trafficked in Mexico. One of the primary drugs in Juarez is methamphetamine, which local activists and community leaders say first surfaced around 2010 and is now the second most consumed drug in Juarez behind marijuana. The synthetic drug is particularly destructive both for its lethality and the level of violence it generates amongst users and the crime groups trafficking it. 9 out of every 10 murders are now linked in some way to the drug, according to reports from the prosecutor's office. Finally, much of the alcohol and drug addiction in Juarez stems from a desire to escape the psychological pressure of daily life. Veronica Corchado, the former director of the Municipal Institute for Women in Juarez, told Insight Crime. As I say, go in and look at this article if you'd like, but this puts it into perspective. And if you think about it, is Juarez now in a cycle it can't get out of? Are other cities in Mexico in cycles they can't get out of? If you don't have kids going to school, if you have kids getting into drugs, alcohol, trafficking at early ages, what hope is there? And to me, that's the tragedy that we all should be focusing on. I don't want to downplay or diminish the significance of the fentanyl deaths and other drug-related deaths in the United States. But I also think it behooves us as concerned citizens, as voters, hopefully as politicians or people with influence in areas, to also realize the real tragic consequences going on in Mexico right now. And all of this, kind of circling back to the conversation last week, makes it harder and harder to see what is the light at the end of the tunnel. How does Mexico fight the cartels in a way that has any meaningful effect? How does the United States assist in that process to the extent that it can? How does the United States develop policies that don't contribute or create more harm than good? As I say often in my daily life, if the answers were simple, somebody would have done it already. But thinking about the kids that are being taught in primary school and what they're going through and what they're seeing on a daily basis, it's tragic. And I think anybody who doesn't recognize that tragedy is doing a disservice. Okay. That one didn't end as positively as I would have liked, but it is what it is. It's the truth. Next week, we had another viewer who said binge watched or binge listened to the podcast and had a suggestion for an episode. We're going to do that next week. Hit me up on the newsletter if you're interested. Keep looking out for the second book, which will be coming soon. And with that shameless self-promotion, that is Cartels, Conspiracies, and Camarena for this week. I'll see you next week, and have a great week, everyone.